The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
How's it going? How was your day? It was weird to be totally out of the hall the whole day. It was lovely to connect with many of you. So here's a transcribed something from Ajahn Sujito that I heard when was sitting a retreat with him, and thought to share that and then just provide some reflections on the theme. So he said, stopping activity can be extremely difficult. Even sometimes one would like to stop because of all this busyness and wrangling and thinking and trying to work things out. It gets quite stressful. But it doesn't stop because it's not really a personal choice. It's an existential position. It's the existential experience of being a self. Always has to be busy because it's trying to find ground. And there isn't true ground in the self. Self is an excluded experience, so it does not really rest into a ground of acceptance. Many people have acceptance issue, sometimes very strong, but I would suggest that we all have acceptance issues. I have acceptance issues. Being a self is extremely busy, to my mind, uncomfortable. And you have to really cultivate this intentionality, above all, just to have the real, deep, loving acceptance of the mess of it all. And then he laughs. I transcribe that. He laughs. Deep laugh. I don't know if that was funny to you, but okay. So we left off with, yeah, just to have the real, deep, loving acceptance of the mess of it all. Without taking it that this is something wrong with you especially. We're all in the mess on the self level. Some of us are better at handling it than others, some of us less deeply, tragically wounded by it, but we're all in that slightly fragile state. And there's a sense of real, loving acceptance. This is about as open as you can be right now. Okay, that's fine. This is about as grounded as you can be right now. This is about as quiet as you can be right now. Just keep sensing that quality of caring and loving. These resonances do keep washing through, and they begin to reassure and calm. And we find, here's the ground. The ground is in the quality of loving acceptance. Not in myself or my strategies, but in the loving acceptance of myself and my strategies. When somebody asks, how are you doing? A lot of times the answer is kind of busy. Yeah, that's a familiar answer. But the more I attend to it, the more I realize that busy is kind of just another word for samsara. Yeah. It's there's just a certain kind of busyness of being human, yeah? The relentlessness of experience, the sense of the demands of living, the constancy of sensory experience. And as we know, we can feel busy when we're not doing much at all. Right? Like the way we kind of orchestrate a whole block of time where we really don't have to do anything. But we like scaffold, you know, and budget the time in these different ways. Or when we're on retreat, it's especially prominent in residential retreat where many days in silence. But maybe even just today, for this day of quiet, where, you know, you'll be sitting there and, okay, the bell rings, it's time to go to lunch or something, and we orchestrate that in our mind as if it's like a CIA reconnaissance mission, you know, and we're like, all right, I'm just gonna, I exit through this door and then shoes right on, and then I, you know, right? It's like, you know, the busyness of the mind as we just try to find our way through the labyrinth of the human condition. Ajahn here is highlighting another, and even maybe we say deeper sense of busyness, and that's a connection between being a self, having this sense of self, and agitation. That the self somehow, the sense of being identified as this, carries with it a certain kind of burden of agitation, even more than just the demands of being human, of taking care of our life, the busyness of modernity. It's like, no, just the very sense of self actually carries a kind of burden of busyness. And so we can see how maybe just the sense of separation that is fostered by self, yeah, is itself a cause of a certain kind of subtle agitation, a certain sense of the heart like longing to rest in something, but we cannot take rest, we cannot find refuge in identity. Yeah. There's maybe we say always some alienation in it. Do you know when you're maybe doing some mental noting and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to find a way of naming experience internally that feels right? And sometimes you have the sense of like, a mental note, it like hits the spot. It's like, yeah, that's what that is. And then other times when the mental note doesn't totally fit with the experience, it's like we're missing it a little bit. Self feels a little bit like that. Yeah? It's just like a little off. A little out of joint. 1650, Pascal said, all of humanity's problems stem from one's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Yeah. And we've been doing it, right? Yeah. What happens when we sit alone in a room? That's a question. Sometimes when we are like avoiding meditation, we have this subtle sense of like what's going to be greeting us when we do sit down, what we're going to be asked to make peace with, what agitation, busyness is going to be waiting there for the heart to open to. And that subtle sense of like what's going to be waiting for us is enough to keep us off the cushion. This is David Foster Wallace. Said, to me, the really interesting question is why dullness proves to be such a powerful impediment to attention. Why we recoil from the dull. Maybe it's because dullness is intrinsically painful, but there might be more to it. Maybe dullness is associated with psychic pain because something that's dull fails to provide enough stimulation to distract people from some other deeper type of pain that is always there, if only in an ambient, low-level way, and which most of us spend nearly all our time and energy trying to distract ourselves from feeling, or at least from feeling directly or with our full attention. TV and waiting rooms, supermarkets, checkouts, airport gates, SUVs, back seats, Walkman, iPods, Blackberries, cell phones that attach to your head. This terror of silence with nothing diverting to do. I can't think anyone really believes that today's so-called information society is just about information. Everyone knows it's about something else way down. It's, I think, maybe 15 years ago or so. And it's actually a little bit scary that now, in some ways, we can engineer our lives, especially with technology, with phones, that we never have to be in a room alone, yeah? Quietly. We really, unless we deliberately do it, we never have to be alone. And that is going to impact the heart-mind over time. So we are learning to relate to this, the certain flavor of agitation that Ajahn Sajitsu is pointing to here is it's more subtle than we're accustomed to attending to, it's worth actually feeling into the way in which self and agitation, self and defensiveness, self and out of jointness works together. So we're learning not to pick the self up as an object to be judged. A couple researchers interested in mindfulness. They write, the question becomes not merely how high or how low is self-esteem, but what one is doing when evaluating the self as an object. The very process of placing oneself in the role of object and then evaluating its worth is problematic. There are people who are preoccupied with their worth. They regularly appraise themselves, compare themselves with others, and struggle to ward off threats to a positive view of self. Whether such individuals come away with a positive or negative conclusion, the very fact that one's esteem is in question suggests a psychological vulnerability. Optimal health is more likely when self-esteem is not a concern because the worth of the self is not at issue. In the Council on comparing ourselves to others, the Buddha said, like, no, don't Don't compare, you know, you don't compare, like, not better than, not worse than, not even equal to. You have to actually step out entirely of the whole realm of self-comparison. And the counsel here from in this quote is like, what would it be like to step out of the realm of evaluating the self as an object? Yeah. What would that entail? What would that, what freedom would that generate? Now, maybe you know the experience that happens typically with those where we're closest to, those we love the most, and over years we become so familiar, they become so familiar to us that in a certain way we start to see them just through the lens of a certain kind of concept. The, like the concepts, they just, it feels so thick that it actually obscures the view of this other human being. Yeah? And the person, in a sense, becomes this kind of object in our own subjectivity. And we can still treat them well and kindly and all of that, but it's like maybe a moment comes where we actually start to look more deeply. It's like, who are you? And we start to shake ourselves out of the kind of mental shorthand of freezing someone into an essence, yeah? And as much as we do that with other people, we do that more so with ourselves, yeah? This maybe is what Ajahn is talking about when he uses that language. The self is an excluded experience. I don't know what he means exactly. But that sense of an excluded experience. So he talks a lot about fields, the relational field, the field of the body, the Dhamma field, yeah, the field leading to freedom. And he doesn't talk so much about things and selves. Yeah, he talks about it much more as a kind of moving away from duality, yeah, of self and other into a relational field, moving away from the solidity of the body into, no, what is this at the level of experience? It is a field, yeah? Energies running. And self is often excluded from the field of experience. Self becomes the perspective rather than another experience to be known. Yeah? So we take up position from a sense of self, and then we look out at the world, and maybe we see change, we see dukkha, we see, you know, we see all this, but it's like it's from the perspective of I am-ness. And so the self, in a way, is excluded from the field of awareness. And our practice is to begin to fold the self, fold whatever it is we call me into awareness. Yeah, what is the ground that creates that sense of division, separation? Like, what is the perspective that I take up that feels like home base, and how can that be brought into awareness? Feelings, yeah, words, images, the outline of my face, the thought of you, that the subtle whisper of thinking, all of this actually tangles in a way to take us to create a sense that there is ground. The ground of self is excluded from awareness. We're folding it in. Yeah, let me try to unpack a little bit more. Yeah. So this speaks to some of that. So Nisargadatta, the only mistake you are making is you take the inner for the outer and the outer for the inner. The mind and feelings are external, but you take them to be intimate. You believe the world to be objective, while it is entirely a projection of your psyche. This is the basic confusion. Yeah. It's maybe slightly hyperbolic, but it's good. Yeah. Don't know. I don't remember where I found it. I don't remember where. It's probably I Am That. Yeah. So the mind and feelings are external, but you take them to be intimate. The world is objective, but it's actually a projection. Yeah. So that sense, the mind and feelings, it so feels like me. And specifically the sense of the narrative character, that's like the auditory thinking that I was pointing to this morning. Philosopher Dennett described the self as like the center of narrative gravity. Yeah, that's a very beautiful description, the center of narrative gravity. Like the center of gravity in an object, it is a kind of theoretician's abstraction. It isn't a thing. Yeah, and so he makes this move, the center of narrative gravity, that sense of like it all converges somewhere in here, that is me. And we know the intimacy, the coziness of that sense of self and the torture of it too. We're being asked to fold it into awareness. And this is part of the practice is coming to feel as comfortable as we can in ourselves, to feel deeply at home in our bodies, in our past, in our wisdom, in our neurosis, our foibles, it's possible to feel very deeply at home in that, even if it does not provide ultimate refuge, it doesn't provide ultimate shelter. Yeah. But Ajahn says, like, we all have acceptance issues. I have acceptance issues. This is like 42 years into a monastic life and a heart that is very, you can feel its potency. Yeah. I have acceptance issues. Yeah. Reminds me of Ajahn Sumedho said something also, you know, kind of decades of monastic practice. And he said, every time I think of myself, I get depressed. Yeah. So this kind of turn to this loving acceptance, which is, it felt very sweet sitting there in the Dharma field with him, and you know, this kind of like renunciate, just the rigors of practice and the wonders of awareness and all of this, and then there's like no, just loving acceptance, loving, like just the mess of it, yeah? We're never going to put the self together perfectly. It's always going to be a little messy, and we got to just love it, yeah? And so we recognize that we're all in the mess of self, we're all in it together, yeah? We can get more and more comfortable. It can feel more and more like a comfortable home, but it will never feel like a true refuge. So this is Heather Havrileski, and she's like a advice columnist. And she is very funny. And I don't know that she's a meditator, but she feels like a Buddhist to me. So this is her giving some advice to somebody and making her own kind of disclosure about her relationship. And I'll unfold how this speaks to where we are in this exploration. So she says, and she's talking about like opening to in a sense, the messiness, the ambivalence of love. And so she writes, my husband is a pretty good cook, but I always know better than him about everything. Sometimes he doesn't clean the counter to my specifications after chopping up a mess of raw meat, for example. I consider his cooking very slow and inefficient, and merely watching him move around the kitchen makes me feel impatient. I grew up watching my mother, who is an amazingly good cook, skilled and relaxed and intuitive with great taste. So even though these days my husband's meals are often better than mine, if I watch him cook, I get picky and pushy and judgmental. So when my husband is cooking, I don't go into the kitchen at all. I know myself. But if you ask me to go in there and observe and then write down my thoughts, I would craft a masterful case against my husband's competence as a person. I would start with the mess, and then I would use that bad choice as an organizing principle and apply it to everything stupid about him. I wouldn't do this because I hate him. I would do it because, A, I have a lot of opinions and feelings, and B, I'm a wound-up person with a laser focus, and C, I actually enjoy making cases for and against people, places, and things. And D, I live in a house with another adult human being who is not me. This adult human does not sound or smell like me, and he doesn't do things the way I do them. Therefore, I sometimes hate him. That is marriage. I also love him. Yeah. So there's something, you know, when I read that, there's something that captures the kind of messy ambivalence of just, all right, I'm just going to have to love this partner, this person, or ourselves. Yeah. And this is not about perfecting the self or something like that. It's not, it's like, all right, how do I actually affirm this all very deeply? And so, okay, I'm a bit of a mess right now. I can't, this is about as open as I can be. This is about as concentrated as I can be. This is about as willing as I can be. That's okay, yeah. And often when we're in the thick of suffering, we try to imagine what's the thread to pull so that all of it untangles. Yeah, like we imagine not suffering at all and compare that to this moment. But I think in those kind of moments, it's better just to try to suffer a tiny bit less. Yeah, just a tiny bit less. Because the idea of not suffering at all is the enemy of this kind of gentle, loving acceptance of it all. Just keep sensing that quality of caring and loving. These resonances do keep washing through, and they do begin to reassure and calm. When I was a kid and would get hurt or, you know, playing sports or something like that, I remember the phrase my mom used to say to me, like, oh, poor boy, yeah? Like, poor boy. There was a lot of tenderness in it, and that phrase like is just like this little shard of my past that's sort of expresses that kind of like gentle, caring, just okay, loving acceptance. Like, oh, and it comes to my mind sometimes. And we start to have some sense that awareness is becoming more trustworthy. Something is holding us. That's like, maybe we don't talk about that so much in practice, but like one of the outcomes of practice, and I don't totally know how to make sense of it, but it's a sense of like, I'm being held by the Dharma. Yeah. Sense of like a certain deep companionship and holding, held by the Dharma. Now, in all of this, the self-love and the emptiness of self, this is not in competition. In fact, the self that is loved is easier to forget than the self that is hated. And maybe they're even on a kind of continuum, that at one end of the continuum is the self-harshness and just the rigidity and like the solidity of self. And then as we move towards a little bit of acceptance, a little bit more of love, self-love, the self is actually becoming more porous. Now, we're not just loving it more, it's actually becoming more porous, softer, more fluid. And then we keep going, we keep saying yes to it rather than no. Sometimes we hear the teachings on self, it's like, all right, Brent Silver, we're going hunting for self, yeah? And like there's a sort of combative approach, yeah? Me versus myself. But no, it's like, it's loving it to death, as one of my teachers said. Yeah. Sokni Rinpoche said, not dwelling in any way whatsoever, and yet totally present throughout everything. And so we keep saying yes to the ground of self. Whatever creates the sense of ground, we keep saying yes to the messiness of it, this loving acceptance. We're not going to find our way through with the self. The self is going to be folded into awareness more and more deeply. And then every kind of self-conception we have, it's not that we argue with it one way or another, it's just that it becomes like a million miles away and utterly irrelevant to the the glory of the moment and the tasks of living. This is the last thing I'll share is very connected with the theme of mortality and death. Because maybe in some ways the self is instantiated, if we think of it as a cause, but the self is, you know, we cause, I cause this. But the self is also, an effect. Yeah. The self is an effect, maybe, of, we say, fear. The self is an effect of the imperative to keep going, to be alive. Yeah? And in a sense, the self is it's what makes death even more scary than it might otherwise be, because there's a sense that it's the end of that somethingness. But if that somethingness is questioned deeply enough, what it means to be alive, to die, it's not that all the grief is dispelled, or it's not a deeply poignant, momentous theme for humans, but something about it is different. Yeah. So the philosopher Derek Parfit talking about the self as calling the deep further fact is the language that he uses. It's difficult to believe that there's no such thing as an all or nothing self, no deep further fact beyond the multitude of small psychological facts that make you who you are. When I believed that my existence was such a further fact, I seem imprisoned in myself. My life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year, and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. I now live in the open air. There's still a difference between my life and the lives of other people, but the difference is less. Other people are closer. I am less concerned about the rest of my life and more concerned about the lives of others. There's a connection when we say, affirm the mess of self so deeply and begin to appreciate its emptiness. There is a connection between that insight and love. That this understanding, this deep affirmation, it's not equivalent to love, as far as I can tell, but it is utterly nonviolent. Yeah. That understanding pacifies the heart in a deep way. And when the heart is poised in this, like, utterly, like, it's not like harm is something we have to restrain ourselves from doing. It would be absurd, yeah. And so the heart has this responsivity and spontaneity. The Brahma-vihara is like, it's so, this is a kind of effortless love that bubbles out of that, out of that non-clinging. this makes more room for us to serve. Just sit for a moment. So whatever goodness arises out of our efforts today, may that be a cause for our welfare and the welfare of those whose lives we encounter. May our hearts be a kind of quiet blessing. So thank you. As always, please pick up whatever is useful and leave the rest behind. It's amazing, you know. It's like in meeting with whatever 15 folks, like just how different the mind streams are, and how, you know, to one person I would want to say one thing and the next person I'd say something very different, but I had to give the same Dharma talk to all of you. Yeah? And so that's like criminally negligent. It is what it is. So, any volunteers for cleanup or okay, yeah, so if a few people to hang out for just maybe 10 minutes or so, right? Yeah. Okay. And the center, and I am supported by your generosity, so that's appreciated. And it's, yeah, very sweet to practice together, and I wish you all well. Thanks.